Hey, everybody. Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, a 10-year-old got raped by an illegal. And then we have Ilya Shapir to unpack what happened at Georgetown University and why the Supreme Court has gone in such a dysfunctional direction. Get involved with Turning Point USA today at tpusa.com. Come to our Student Action Summit at tpusa.com/SAS. That is tpusa.com/SAS. You can email me your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. And support the Charlie Kirk Show at charliekirk.com/support. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage. For personalized loan services you can count on, go to andrewandtodd.com, the wonderful andrewandtodd.com. So I want to tell you guys about a very interesting story. It's with our next guest, Ilya Shapiro. I've known Ilya for quite a while. We spent some fun time together. So Ilya was run out of Georgetown University. It's an extraordinary story, and he's the author of a new book called Supreme Disorder. Exposes how politics has infiltrated the Supreme Court in the worst possible way. With us right now to help us unpack that is Ilya Shapiro. Ilya, welcome to the Charlie Kirk Show.
Good to be with you. I've also recently launched a new Substack, Shapiro's Gavel. So in addition to the book, go check that out.
Very good. So Ilya, tell us what happened at Georgetown. It's a very interesting story. And I mean, you know, I'm no fan of college. That's not a mystery to anybody. So it just basically confirms all of my criticisms, which I'm going to deliciously enjoy. Tell us what happened to you at Georgetown University.
Sure. I've been at the Cato Institute for nearly 15 years, the nation's preeminent libertarian think tank, and decided that maybe I should look for a new challenge, have a different kind of impact. Got a very interesting offer from Georgetown Law School to become executive director of their Center for the Constitution. As it turned out, the rest of the law school is basically the center against the Constitution, but we can get to that. A few days before I was due to take that job in February was when Justice Breyer's retirement leaked. And I was doing media on that. Supreme Court politics is my area. And I was critical of President Biden's decision to limit his candidate search by race and gender. Famously, he said he would pick a Black woman. And I thought, you know, if I was a progressive Democrat president, I would pick Judge Sri Srinivasan, Chief Judge of the D.C. Circuit, who's an Indian American, would be the first Indian or Asian American, happens to be an immigrant as well. So lots of diversity points too, but not the right kind, it turns out. And so by operation of logic, we would, in my mind, end up with someone less qualified, a worse choice for a Democratic president. And given Biden's criteria, I phrased that in Twitter's limitations as a lesser Black woman. And really, it's those three words that got me in hot water, the manufactured outrage machine on social media and beyond, calling for my head. I eventually was onboarded, but immediately suspended pending an investigation into whether my comments violated the university's harassment and anti-discrimination policies, 4 months of purgatory after the initial 4 days of hell. And ultimately, one of the bright lawyers looked at the calendar and said, oh, he wasn't an employee when he tweeted, and therefore the policies didn't even apply. Now, obviously, they were cynically just waiting it out. The process was the punishment. Once the students got off campus at the end of the semester, That's when they could reinstate me. I celebrated that technical victory, but once I read the fine print, the report by my inquisitors, the Office of Institutional Diversity, Equity, and Affirmative Action, that kind of Orwellian crowd, they were setting me up for a fall. Basically, they were putting in a subjective standard whereby anytime I said something or wrote something in media commentary, in class, what have you, that offended somebody. Somebody claimed offense. They didn't like it. That would be a hostile educational environment, subjecting me again to discipline and investigation, termination, what have you. And so I had to resign. And like most people, when you quit their job, I did so in the pages of the Wall Street Journal and noisily trying to shine a light on the rot at Georgetown specifically and academia more broadly. It was simply untenable for me to fulfill the duties that I'd been hired to do.
Well, and Ilya, this is, you don't have to comment on this, but just center-right donors, libertarian, conservative, Republican donors, they have to stop funding these schools. I mean, the way you were treated was horrible and terrible, and you're a very prudent, fair, you know, judicial expert. There's nothing controversial about you at all. And you're just doing your job. You're a professor. You write about how politics shouldn't be in the Supreme Court, and they put you on this entire propaganda campaign. And so just for donors out there, you have to stop giving money to these institutions. A lot of these institutions are propped up by the very people who don't share the values of these colleges and universities. Ilya, can you just talk a little bit, though? It's one thing to have disagreement. I'm sure you had a lot of that throughout college, but this is different. This is now, I'm going to punish you because of disagreement. It's the use of force. Can you just add some context to that? Because disagreement is fun and what makes life lively and interesting. But then using force is a completely different step that the Academy said they would never go.
Absolutely. That's a really good question, Charlie. And by the way, if someone's looking for a place to park their money, if not their alma mater, I'm now with the Manhattan Institute, which is doing fantastic work, looking to expand the constitutional footprint there, which I direct. The problem is, you put your finger on it. This is not the age old, decades old conservative complaint that universities are too left wing. I graduated college nearly 25 years ago. I graduated law school nearly 20 years ago. I don't think the ratio of liberals to moderates to conservatives among either student or faculty has really changed all that much. What has changed is administrative bureaucratic bloat, and especially these DEI offices, the diversity, equity, inclusion, that it's an Orwellian title because they subvert intellectual diversity, prevent equal opportunity, and exclude anyone who dissents from the progressive orthodoxy. But the administrators kowtow and placate the extreme left radicals. It's not simply that they're, you know, liberal. It's that they're empowering this narrowing and skewing to the left of the Overton window, the permissible range of policy views or right think, as it were. The administrators, I don't think, for the most part, aren't woke radicals, but they're spineless and they're giving grease to the squeaky wheel of those activists that are demanding this illiberal. That's the point. The illiberalness is the problem, not the liberalness of takeover of academia.
So let me ask you, Ilya, and this is just more of a philosophical question. I'm totally curious. And this kind of illiberalism has made me more conservative and definitely less libertarian in believing in kind of we can get along with the other side. Has that happened to you? I'm just curious. And you know, we can talk about this offline if you're interested or whatever. Is there a part of you where you think that kind of live and let live, I won't bother you and you won't bother me, that contract has kind of been invalidated?
I don't think it's a question of first principles. I think it's a question of pragmatism and what you do about the problems that you see. So traditionally, libertarians divide the world into public policy and everything else. And there are certain first principles that you have about what government should and shouldn't do. And you enact those. And everything else is, well, that's, you know, people have different preferences and you can agree and live your life you know, very conservatively or very, you know, whatever. But as long as it doesn't affect what the government's doing, that's not an issue for libertarian policy. The problem is that in this day and age, it's the culture and it's different institutional power that by the time it gets to yes. actual levers of public policy, it's too late. If those UC Hastings law students who shouted me down on March 1st that prevented, you know, at Yale, there was also a March of this year was a terrible month for free speech and, you know, getting events shut down. Again, not protested, not being asked hard questions, but just being shouted down and prevented from holding events. If those students 15 years from now, 20 years from now are in positions of power, it's too late at that point. And so It's not even a matter of that I'm proposing that there be a government board to take over universities. Not at all. But it does mean that we have to be smarter at identifying and addressing the threats.
It's just an interesting thing because there's the I want to live in that live and let live world. I don't want to care about other people's business, but they're caring about mine and they're caring about children. And so that's an interesting question. How do you respond to that? You brought up kind of libertarianism and the libertarian view of public policy and everything else. But is it fair to say that within kind of a libertarian point of view is they don't like concentrated power? And could you make the argument, though, that we have concentrated cultural power, cultural monopolies, and we have financial monopolies and corporate ones? I'm not saying state power is necessarily the answer, but it seems as if the question of who is dominating our life is more than just the state. It's all these other instruments of influence. What are your thoughts?
No, that's no doubt the case. And if private actors are oppressing you, the person feeling that oppression doesn't feel better that it's not being done under color of state law or what have you. The problem is the remedies are more difficult. You know, you talk about concentrated power. Well, that sounds like antitrust. Well, should we break up some of these places? Antitrust is a very crude tool. You know, by the time we went after Microsoft, it was no longer a monopoly. Or remember that Netscape monopoly over browsers and things like that. I think we might want to learn, go back to the Industrial Revolution. And there was kind of this conception, including among classical liberals, the modern libertarians, of a third space that are private entities that are affected with the public interest. And it wasn't about Teddy Roosevelt's progressive antitrust, breaking up the trusts, but it was thinking about this public-private hybrid that's it's a complicated sort of situation that we're not going to resolve during this conversation, Charlie.
Yeah, no doubt. I think it's interesting. So tell us about the book. The Supreme Court in particular has been corrupted by politics when it should inherently be a non-political branch. I believe the left did this with the Warren Court and the Burger Court. They politicized Supreme Court hearings with Bork and then Clarence Thomas and Brett Kavanaugh. Tell us about how the Supreme Court, which was always supposed to be the least political branch, has actually become the most political branch.
Well, it's not exactly right that it's become the most political branch or that's been more politicized. In fact, the reason I wrote the book was in the wake of the Kavanaugh hearings. I wanted to see where exactly we went off the rails. Why is the Supreme Court been dragged down into the same kind of toxic cloud that infects or envelops the rest of our public discourse? Because the world didn't start with Kavanaugh or Clarence Thomas or Robert Bork. So I wanted to look at that. And it turns out, you go back to George Washington, and politics has played a role in judicial confirmations. Washington had a Supreme Court nominee rejected for political reasons by the Senate. What's different now is that judicial philosophy is central to the way politics plays into the court, not just partisanship or someone's real politics or slavery or some of these other issues, but methods of interpretation. And you have the culmination of several trends where interpretive theory maps onto partisan preference at a time when the parties are more ideologically sorted and polarized than at least the Civil War, if not ever. And so you have these irreconcilable visions of what the judiciary, what the Supreme Court should be doing at a time when the court is very, very powerful, not political, but powerful, because over the course of decades, power has accreted to Washington and within Washington to the judiciary because of the growth of the administrative state. Now, there's a lot there to unpack, I know, but ultimately, my point is you're not going to solve whatever problem you think you see with the Supreme Court by tinkering around the edges with the so-called structural reforms, whether that's court packing or term limits or changing the way hearings are conducted, because the problem is not with the process, it's with the product. It's with the warping of the separation of powers, the ignoring of federalism, and fundamentally having Washington decide so many major issues. Yep. And within Washington, the court every June deciding half a dozen of the major political problems in such a large, diverse, pluralistic society.
Okay. Well, Ilya, thank you again so much for joining us. I want to just tell you again to pick up a copy of the book, Supreme Disorder. Ilya, great conversation as always. Thank you for joining us. Hope to see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you. And the new Substack, Shapiro's Gavel. So there you go.
Hey, everybody. As you know, our friend Mike Lindell has an amazing passion to help everyone get the best sleep of your life. He didn't stop by simply creating the best pillow. Nope. You know, Mike, he's got lots of energy. He's done it again by introducing his My Slippers. For a limited time, you'll only save $90 on a pair of My Slippers. This blowout sale of the year won't last, so order now. Mike has taken over 2 years to develop it. The My Slippers are designed to wear indoor and out all day long. Made with MyPillow foam and impact gel to help protect fatigue. Made with quality leather suede. I love Mike Lindell. I know you do too. Support him and get something comfortable in return. Call 800-875-0425. Use promo code Kirk. Or just go to MyPillow.com and click on the radio listener square and use promo code Kirk. This offer will not last long, so order now with promo code Kirk at MyPillow.com. MyPillow.com, promo code Kirk.
You know, they always say the big lie with the 2020 election. The big lie. And what happens when they push forward a big lie? And this is a very dark and disturbing story. So bear with us as we go through this. It involves graphic nature of minors and disgusting material, but it also involves a fact pattern that the regime doesn't want you to talk about. So Roe versus Wade was reversed, sending the issue of abortion back down to the states. States can make their own laws with abortion, and that's the way it should have been the entire time. There is no federal right to abortion. And so Joe Biden then commented about a tragic story that there was a 10-year-old girl who had to travel out of state from to Indiana for an out-of-state abortion, that a 10-year-old got pregnant, which is just hard to even grasp, 10-year-olds getting pregnant, very well possibly putting her life in danger or life in jeopardy. Even the most pro-life people, including Orthodox rabbis and some people in the pro-life community, including myself, the only exception that I would say is okay for abortion is if the life of the mother is threatened. That is an understandable position that is articulated in a fair amount of literature as to why, because it would, if a life of the mother would be threatened, then they could potentially not have future children and many other things. Now, some people debate if there's even ever cases where the life of the mother is actually threatened. So this 10-year, I don't agree with that, but that's an opinion of some people in pro-life circles. However, this is an extraordinarily rare case that got a lot of attention. Joe Biden wanted to seize on it for political gain. So here's Joe Biden politicizing just an unspeakable tragedy. It's just a tragedy when anyone gets raped. And then Joe Biden talks about a 10-year-old girl had to travel to Indiana for an out-of-state abortion, play cut 44.
This week it was reported that a 10-year-old girl was a rape victim in Ohio. 10 years old. And she was forced to have to travel out of the state to Indiana to seek to terminate the presidency and maybe save her life. That's last part is my judgment. 10 years old. 10 years old.
Now, it sounds extraordinary. Now, mind you, the Ohio law allows for exceptions of medical emergencies in the case of the life of the mother. So Joe Biden's just lying here. So the Ohio Attorney General comes out and debunks this claim, but the story gets even more perverse. Play cut 45.
Have you had anybody come to you in your state to say we're looking into this? A police report was filed?
Not a whisper. And we work closely with we have a decentralized law enforcement system in Ohio. Not a whisper anywhere. It's also the fact that in Ohio, the rape of a 10-year-old means life in prison. I know our prosecutors and cops in this state. There's not one of them that wouldn't be turning over every rock in their jurisdiction if they had the slightest hint that this had occurred.
And he continues to say, cut 46, continues to say that the heartbeat law has exceptions for medical emergencies, so if she was raped, if the life of her mother was threatened, she would have been able to leave the state for treatment. Play cut 46.
Speaking of hoaxes, though, can I correct something that everybody's reporting wrong nationally?
Sure.
Ohio's heartbeat law has a medical emergency exception, broader than just the life of the mother. This young girl, if she exists and if this horrible thing actually happened to her, breaks my heart to think about it. She did not have to leave Ohio to find treatment.
So because of all the attention that Joe Biden put on this, all of a sudden people are saying, is this true or not? So at the time, the Ohio Attorney General says not a whisper. And so the entire story started to gain traction and people started to go report on this. Like, what exactly is going on here? And so it actually turns out half of the story was true. According to the Indianapolis Star, which first reported this month that a girl had to travel to Indiana because it was the point she could no longer access an abortion in Ohio, which was actually not true. The story made international headlines, and Biden used it as a case, as an example of how restrictive an abortion ban can happen, and imagine being that little girl. Well, then Attorney General of Ohio, Dave Yost, who you just heard, said he did not believe the case was real because he had not heard a report filed. But here's the interesting thing, is that now there has been an arrest of the person who did this. So at the time, Yost said, I hadn't heard anything about it, but because Joe Biden made this entire case, we now find out who actually did this. And this 10-year-old was raped by an illegal alien, otherwise known as Joe Biden's best buddies and friends, the people that Joe Biden let 7,000 into our country. So the 10-year-old girl was raped by a foreign national that we allowed to come into our country, that Joe Biden allowed to come into America, that Joe Biden invited into America. For what purpose? So the suspected rapist accused of impregnating the 10-year-old child was now just arrested in Ohio, who happens to be a foreign national illegal that Joe Biden wants to potentially give amnesty for, and potentially was flown up north by Joe Biden in the middle of the night with underage migrants in New York and Ohio and all these places where he does these places. They do the middle of the night airplane flights. So Joe Biden tries to politicize a tragedy when in reality, Joe Biden's the one that actually created the conditions for that tragedy to exist in the first place. You read from the story, it just takes your breath away. Again, I gave you the disclaimer ahead of time. I'll give you it again. A Columbus, Ohio man has been charged with impregnating a 10-year-old girl. The story of a girl who traveled to Indiana to seek an abortion following the Roe versus Wade decision caught international attention and was at the receiving end of some scrutiny due to there being no charges laid in the case. Police say Gershon Fuentes, who lived in Columbus's northwest side, was arrested on Tuesday after confessing to the raping of a child on at least two occasions. Fuentes has been charged with felony rape. According to Detective Jeffrey Hoon, Columbus police were made aware of the young girl's pregnancy through referral by the Franklin County Children's Services. The girl received an abortion at an Indianapolis facility. Hoon said, quote, they also testify the DNA from the clinic in Indianapolis is being tested against the samples from Fuentes as well as the child's siblings to confirm the contribution to the aborted fetus. Fuentes is an illegal immigrant and will not be held without bond. Well, that's a double negative. Ebner said that the high bond was necessary and that Fuentes is considered a flight risk. Ebner sets a $2 million bond for Fuentes, who's being held in the Franklin County Jail. Chad Wolf, former DHS secretary, came on the show and said there's 3 million illegals coming into America every... How many rapists are coming into our country every single year? Are you allowed to say that out loud? How many child rapists do we allow into our country thanks to Joe Biden's border policies and weak Republicans on the border that allow that to happen? Are you not allowed to say that? I'm just asking the question. How many? 1,000? 5,000? 10,000? 25,000? 100,000? Drew Hernandez, Turning Point USA contributor, you might remember, he came on our program, had some very powerful videos exposing how these women come across the border with condoms and other contraceptives. Now, we know they're likely to get raped across the southern border. So the way that I think Joe Biden and these people rationalize it is like, well, we'll just have abortion everywhere. And so if you get raped, so what? Just go get an abortion. So Joe Biden says, wow, imagine being that little girl. Yeah. Imagine being the little girl who got raped by somebody that's in the country because of you, Joe Biden. Illegal immigrant wanted for alleged rape of minor girls arrested in Massachusetts. Happens more than people actually want to say out loud. Why are we letting this happen? For diversity? For equity? For inclusion? For cheap labor? It's a sick story. It really is. Another story from Tennessee. Man deported with at least one now charged with rape of child in Tennessee. Immigration Customs Enforcement across the country in New York and San Francisco and Seattle and Portland, they don't want to enforce federal immigration law. They have seceded from the federal government and they've allowed it to just run amok. How many crimes are being committed by illegals for foreign nationals that should not be in our country altogether? Why are we not allowed to say that out loud? Remember the man who raped the woman on the crowded train where everyone else stood idly by and did nothing? Very similar to, unfortunately, the pattern of behavior that we saw in the Uvalde shooting. He was released from immigration detention and never deported. Illegal alien. How many Americans have to die? How many people have to be raped before we take this seriously? I know all of you take it seriously and it's making your blood boil, and it should. I wonder if Joe Biden's going to mention this in his upcoming press conference. He made a big point of it previously. We got to talk about it. Lori Lightfoot has something to say about abortion. Play cut 58.
There's been some notion out there in state other state legislatures that they are going to bring legal action against healthcare providers and against women themselves if they travel outside of states where abortion is banned to a city like Chicago or a state like Illinois. I mean, I have to tell you, as an African American, what I hear when I hear that is fugitive slave laws like were back in the day where they're chasing people who are seeking freedom. It's the same kind of dynamic here.
In July in Chicago, 27 people have been shot and killed, 151 shot and wounded, 178 total shot with 29 homicides. Year to date, over 324 people in Chicago have been shot and killed, 1,442 shot and wounded, 1,766 total shot, and 355 total homicides. And Lori Lightfoot is lecturing us about Clarence Thomas and fugitive slave laws. Joe Biden was very quick to try to take a victory lap, saying this is why we need Roe versus Wade, national abortion, because of a 10-year-old that had to travel to Indiana for an out-of-state abortion threatening her life. What he didn't tell you is who actually did the crime itself. It wasn't an American. Someone that came here illegally, broke in line, illegally harbored themselves, invited by the same sort of malevolent and sinister forces that are pushing forward all of these open border policies, and quite honestly, the intentional treasonous invasion of the country. But don't worry, they say, toxic cisgendered men, they're the greatest threat to democracy. White men, they're going to destroy America. That's what you can receive when you go to a college campus.
Look, we know rates are inching up, and they're still historically low. But if you're tired of the high cost of renting, there's still time to buy a home. And I was just talking about this on our program. You got to buy. And by the way, you could always refinance. If you think rates are too high, you could always refinance. So go to andrewandtodd.com. They're the ones to contact right now to get you financing into your new home. They're not just mortgage brokers. They're lenders with Sierra Mortgage. They've been through multiple ups and downs and economic markets like you can imagine, just like the ones we're seeing today. So you just got to go to andrewandtodd.com. Whether you're considering owning versus renting or seeking a safer haven for your family in a new state, now's the time to get a pre-approved loan to give you the edge over other buyers. I know Andrew and Todd. They're great Americans. We hang out together. They love the Lord. They're great people. So just go to andrewandtodd.com. Do not wait. Get your pre-approved loan today while rates are still historically low. And by the way, again, some of you might say, oh, Charlie, I'm going to wait for the rates to go, you know, down and all this. Okay, well, then what if the property is worth twice as much in 3 years because there's so many dollar bills out there? AndrewandTodd.com. AndrewandTodd.com can guide you through all of this. And remember, you can always refinance. So go to AndrewandTodd.com.
So many stories to hit here. We're going to be covering, I want to do this justice. I want to do kind of a COVID update, because I believe they're actually going to be bringing back lockdowns, back vaccine mandates and mask mandates. I don't think this is far from over. I was just traveling to the airport a couple days ago, and I was shocked at how many people are still voluntarily wearing masks. Now, if that's one of you in our audience, okay, I'm not going to judge you. I'm just saying, well, if you're making a child wear a mask, I am going to judge you. But if you're wearing a mask, whatever, maybe you have a health condition and the mask makes you feel better, or maybe it's a special mask I'm not aware of. But not going to put judgment on you. What does shock me, though, is how many people are wearing them that are young. And again, this is not scientific. It's not mathematic by any means. It's not a control sample. But I do want to say this, though. The vast majority of people that are voluntarily wearing masks at airports are young. The younger people seem to be more afraid of COVID than older people. people over 60. And why exactly is that? And what's so interesting is that many of them say they hate their life, they can't stand what they're living through, and yet they're so afraid to die. It's a very interesting paradoxical existence. Now, part of it is probably because younger people are on their phones more, and they're just being fed this nonstop stream of fear-induced propaganda and paranoia. Fauci came out and he said, quote, this is what's so funny about this. Fauci admits COVID-19 vaccines do not protect overly well against infection. Oh, you don't say, Anthony Fauci. But what's so funny is that when Fox News posted this image, Facebook had a disclaimer underneath Fauci's statement that said, visit the COVID-19 information resource for vaccine resources, which is like, you got to be careful if Fauci's spreading vaccine disinformation. I have a question. Did Anthony Fauci take ivermectin? Just a very simple question. What was Tony Fauci's treatment protocol when he got COVID? Did Anthony Fauci take azithromycin? Did Anthony Fauci get a vitamin D booster shot? Did Anthony Fauci get monoclonal antibodies? Did Anthony Fauci get intravenous liquids? Did Anthony Fauci take a metrodose pack, which are otherwise known as steroids, which can relax the lungs and breathe to be able to overcome the cytokine storm? We're going to have to get into more of this tomorrow, so you guys got to subscribe to hear about it. We just don't have enough time to do it. But the WHO, we got to build out the whole, I got to make this argument. It's going to take some time into it. But let's play this just as a teaser for tomorrow. Play clip 29.
The Emergency Committee on COVID-19 met on Friday last week and concluded that the virus remains a public health emergency of international concern.
WHO recommends masks again and preps the world for global lockdown in the fall. Still an emergency. They're extending the emergency use authorization. Now remember, the emergency is a prerequisite to your freedoms and liberties being taken away. The emergency is a prerequisite to mass mail-in voting. If you want to talk about an October surprise, if you want to talk about a midterm surprise, if they're able to get COVID-induced paranoia back into the front of people's minds, even for 90 days, they will be able to justify a momentary unconstitutional mass mail-in balloting scheme. Mail-in ballots are necessary and needed for the regime to not lose as terribly as they did, as terribly as I think they will in November, absent an October surprise or a curveball. The Democrats right now seem awfully satisfied and content with the pure implosion of their political prospects. So we need to kind of give you an update of all the things that are happening. Masks, monkeypox, vaccine mandates, WHO. That has kind of gone to the back burner. We need to bring that to the front of the line. So we're going to do that tomorrow, either in the first hour or the second hour. You guys can, that's why you got to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss it. And remember, Xavier Becerra said there's a strong chance we'll see a resurgence of the virus this fall. So if they're planning something, it could be that. Maybe there's COVID fatigue, but I don't know. Not what I saw at the airport. I saw a lot of young people that are more scared than ever. We'll have to discuss that tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Email me your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thanks so much for listening, and God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.